When the salty war is over, oh, how happy I shall be. When I get my silly clothes on, no more soldiering for me. No more church parades on Sunday. No more asking for a pass. I shall tell the sergeant major to stick his pulses up his ass. When this lousy war is over, oh, how happy I shall be. When I get my civvy clothes on, no more soldiering for me. I shall sound my own reveille. I shall make my own tattoo. No more NCOs to curse me. No more bleeding army stew. NCOs will all be navvies, privates riding motor cars. NCOs will smoke their woodlights, privates puff their big cigars. No more standing to entrenches, only one more church parade. No more shivering on the fire step, no more tinkler's marmalade.
And yes, those men did get their civvy clothes on, and they went home, those old soldiers, together with their wounds, their memories, their missing limbs. They left their fallen mates behind them, either lost to the battlefield or in cemeteries with wooden crosses marking the location of their graves. The work of Sir Fabian Ware hadn't yet really started. And then they got in their motor cars, as they said they would, and they returned to the battlefield in vast numbers in the 1920s and 30s. And then, as they did so, many of them wrote down what they saw. And thankfully, there are many accounts that have now been published or were published at the time, and many of these have been reprinted. And in these accounts, they describe how the battlefield had changed 10, 13, 20 years after the war, right up the last battlefield tourists, the last pilgrims from the First World War were still visiting the First World War battlefields on the eve of the Second World War in 1939. What did they find when they went back to the battlefields? Did they stand in their old fire trenches or shelter in the dugouts just as they had done all those years earlier, sheltering from shell fire? Or perhaps these dugouts is where they were treated for a wound, a blighted wound that saw them return to England. Now, many of these accounts that I've written are just descriptions. They're very dry, really, and they describe what they actually saw. The preserved trenches, the newly built cemeteries, the memorials and all that sort of thing. And in this podcast, what I wanted to do was to go back to the battlefields with those men in the 1920s and the 1930s, and not just describe what they saw in terms of the battlefields and the memorials and the cemeteries, but how did they feel about it? How did it make them remember their comrades? What did Ypres and Albert and places like that actually look like? At this time, just 20 years after the war, places like the Cloth Hall and St Martin's Cathedral in Ypres hadn't yet been fully rebuilt. It wasn't until the 1960s that the Cloth Hall was actually finished. And what about the Iron Harvest? We still see old pieces of shrapnel balls, bits of bullets, sometimes personal equipment, lying around in the battlefields when we go there now. But what did they find on their return to the battlefields? Well, in this podcast, we're going to find out, because I'm going to use a few of those published accounts, and we're going to go together back to the 1920s and 1930s and look at those battlefields through the eyes of the veterans who returned to those battlefields between the wars. It's going to be an absolutely fascinating journey. Now, when I take tours over to the battlefields now, The first thing that people are always interested in is the Iron Harvest. It's still coming to the surface, the remnants of the Great War, those shells and bullets and Lord knows what else. Occasionally human bodies or parts of human bodies come to the surface. Hand grenades, still seem to see those pineapple-shaped British bombs that were produced in their millions during the Great War. They're still there. You often see them lying on the side of the road. And the first thing I always say to people is, if you see this stuff, look at it, photograph it, but please, if it's a live shell or a live hand grenade or anything else, please don't touch it, because they're as dangerous now as they were then. And there are many accounts, as we'll see in a minute, of tourists being wounded, if not killed, by the debris of the Great War. It's still live. It's still got explosives and shrapnel and gas inside. And it's still a killer in the 21st century, as it was over 100 years ago. And we have evidence of this in quite a few of the books that I've looked at. And the first one that I looked at was simply called The Western Battlefield, A Guide to the British Line. And it was written by a Lieutenant Colonel T.A. Lowe, who was with the Royal Irish Regiment and later commanded the 1st Battalion of the Royal Irish Fusiliers. And he returned to the battlefield as early as 1920. And at the start of the book, as many good guidebooks do, he tells you that walking is the best way to see the battlefields. Now, we know that, don't we? He says the best way to tour the battlefields is to walk them. A motor or train is very well up to a certain point, but there is nothing like walking if one wants to visit the places where things happened and men fought. Walking has the additional advantage of being the most inexpensive method of travel. And the poor man will have the consolation of knowing that by walking, he is seeing a great deal more of the detail of the country than the motorist could possibly see. Also, as the majority of the troops employed in the war were infantrymen, he will feel that he is tramping as they were obliged to tramp, minus the burden of a rifle, equipment and heavy pack. Details which are well calculated to minimise the delights of a walking tour. But then he talks about what to avoid. He says, old shells and bombs. Some of these souvenirs are still lying about in unexplored places. They have a nasty way of waking up, even after the long years of repose. If you're not tired of life, leave them well alone. Already I see a small party of tourists has had the misfortune to become seriously injured by the explosion of a gas shell, inadvertently kicked by one of them while jumping over an old trench. I also know of a lady who, in stooping to pick up what she imagined to be a souvenir, sustained a great shock in discovering it was really an old boot, and inside the boot were human bones. The best and most useful kind of souvenirs are old empty shell cases, which can easily be found. They can be polished up brightly and make beautiful vases and flower pots. Then there was a magazine called 20 Years After, and it had been edited by Major General Sir Ernest Swinton. And it's been put into, I think it's 3 bound volumes by Naval and Military Press. And it's a real eye-opener to what the battlefields look like. And there's an account written by one veteran returning to the battlefields. And he also talks about seeing people searching the battlefields for souvenirs. Now, there was no eBay in 1938, but there was still a trade. And this particular veteran, I don't know who he was, wrote this account. He doesn't hold back when he explains how he feels about these people looking for souvenirs that they could sell for financial profit. This is what he says. A trade for human dregs is how he entitles it. How near it all is may be seen from the piles of rusty shells and jagged fragments turned up day after day, year after year, at each succeeding passage or plough or harrow across the fields. Trade is still being done in this raw material. In every village that once upon a time boasted a mention in dispatches, stacked waist high against a wall awaiting the passage of the lorry which will take them away to the furnaces. Dregs of humanity drawn into the game soon after the end of the war, when prices ruled absurdly high, still eke out an existence in these parts, plodding down at heel and clothed in tattered dungarees in the wake of the horse or motor-drawn plough. You may see them strung out in groups of 3 or 4, stumbling along with heads bent, eyes glued to the ground, each carrying a pitifully slender sack into which at intervals after stooping, the owner drops some fragment that he has found. The fund they draw upon is practically inexhaustible. It is doubtful whether as yet more than a small fraction of the total quantity of metal rained down during the course of the Battle of the Somme alone can have been gleaned. They will tell you, though, that the harvest no longer gives what it gave in the early 30s, that the supply itself is becoming exhausted. But they forget that each year they turn over the soil, turn the year before, and that in the heavy rains of autumn and winter, the ponderous metal content must surely have sunk below the reach of the spike and chair. Still, so long as some remains, so long will the scavengers continue to ply their no longer profitable trade, and the fact that at least once in every month a live shell takes it into its head to go off when struck appears to offer no discouragement, all the more pieces available for the survivors. It would be wonderful to go back in time to find that veteran and to explain to him that, 90 odd years after his visit to the Somme, that those pieces of shells are still finding their way to the surface, and they will continue to do so probably for hundreds of years to come. As I was reading those accounts, I thought of a couple of examples of when I've come across people who wouldn't believe me when I told them on battlefield tours that the iron harvest is still dangerous. And we came across an enormous shell on one occasion sitting by the side of Mametz Wood, where so many Welsh and Prussians fell during July of 1916. And this shell had been there for some time, I believe. And the client I was with, I explained to him the danger of it, and it still could be full of gas, high explosive shrapnel. And as I say, he wouldn't believe me, and he said that if it was dangerous, by now it would have been removed. And he got dangerously close to it, and in the end I had to shout at him to get away. And on another occasion, just a few hundred yards away, but a different time, we found one of those Mills hand grenades lying by the side of the road, close to the London Cemetery by the side of High Wood. And people I was with, they said, wouldn't that be great to take back as a souvenir to the United Kingdom? Despite the fact, as I say, I'd explained to them the dangers of this iron harvest. And I said, by all means, yes, I'd given up by this time trying to convince them that it was dangerous. I said, yeah, you can take that back. I said, but I'll be making my own separate arrangements to return to the United Kingdom, and good luck. Eventually, I managed to get through to them that it wasn't going to happen. Not on Terry's tours, anyway. There is another account of the battlefields that was written by a Captain Taylor when he walked the battlefields 10 years after the armistice in 1928. And he tells us that he too saw lots of the iron harvest lying around. And he says, here is a portion of a Mills bomb, obviously recovered from deep down in the ground. The pin was never drawn, and the vicious little detonator still resides in its sleeve. You might construct a score of stories round that ugly, dirty piece of metal, as indeed you might find broken, rusty bits of bayonets, bullet-pierced water bottles and other components of these little heaps of small scrap iron. But then he says, even just 10 years after the war in 1928, there was little to be seen of those trenches where he'd served. He says, apart from cemeteries and memorials, such small things as these are now the only links between the Flanders that was and the Flanders that is. It is useless to seek remains of old strong points and redoubts, bits of trenches or woodland. Indeed, some of the notorious woods have disappeared entirely. Men who remember days of hell and heroism at Stirling Castle and Jackdaw Trench would have the greatest difficulty in locating such points, even approximately, and it's almost impossible to reconstruct the ebb and flow of a fight, which was one of the most memorable in a series of desperate struggles. And he adds, the civilian that goes to Passchendaele must go as a pilgrim and not as a strategist, for to stand on the ridge and to look with a critical eye over this area in which so many thousands of our best lost their lives is only to ask questions that will never be answered. And I think that's the challenge of the battlefield guide now. We've got tours that those men didn't have in 1928, 1938, We've got things like linesmen, an electronic device with a GPS signal sitting on top of hundreds of trench maps that can help us locate the positions of those old trenches. And we've got thousands of photographs that we can print off and take with us. And of course, most importantly, we've got the stories, the accounts of the men that we can read when we're standing on those spots like Passchendaele. In some ways, the passage of time has actually helped historians, both professional and amateurs like me. And he mentioned there about some of the woods no longer being there. I mean, you know, places like Sanctuary Wood and High Wood, Delville Wood, of course, they're still there and we can go and explore them. But one of those woods that's no longer there was once just by the side of what is now the Hooge Crater Cemetery on the Menning Road. There was a site there called Zouve Wood, and that was never replanted after the war. So we can only imagine when we look at the exploits of the soldiers in Zouve Wood, what actually happened there. There's no way of seeing that wood now. It's just fields. Now, the other account that I'm going to use in this podcast is a fantastic one. It's a book that I've read over and over again, and it's simply called 13 Years After. And it was written by a man called Corporal Will Bird, and he served with the 42nd Battalion of the Royal Highlanders. And in autumn of 1931, he was sent to France and Belgium by a magazine called Maclean's in order to write the story of the front revisited. Now, he knew the ground he was going to travel to again because he'd served there from December 1916 until February 1919. He served in the Vimy area at Hill 70 at Luz, Passchendaele, Amiens, Arras, Cambrai and Mons. He was a corporal. He specialised in scouting. And in the last few weeks of the war, when it returned to Mons, he was involved in an action which was to see him be awarded the military medal. So we're going to follow his story across the battlefields. In 1931, as he says in the title of the book, this is 13 years after the armistice, and it's fascinating. He really does describe his feelings and the feelings of his comrades as he returns to those battlefields that are still at this stage well within living memory of not just him, but most of the survivors that returned home. So his first stop on his journey is a place that will be known to so many people that listen to this podcast. It's the Menning Gate in Ypres. And this is what he says about his visit. He says the gate itself is wonderful and the 55,000 names on the panels seem to be whispering to you. Now, at this stage, there was 55,000 names on the memorial itself, but as the years have gone by, several hundred of those have been found on the battlefields and their names removed. He then goes on to say, he said, I went back at 8 o'clock that night to hear the last post. It was cold and dark and chilly, and there were many present. Many who go faithfully summer and winter. The police stand in the street facing the gate at the salute, while the bugles, silver ones, ring out with a sweetness more poignant than words can describe. Many, many times have I heard the last post, but never as you hear it at the Menning Gate. It is perfect. It is lovely, exquisite, indescribably tragic. The death of another day, a music that seems to finger the very chords of your heart, stilling all else. All veterans go to the gate in the evening and one meets men from all corners. Now, when we go to the Menning Gate to hear the last post, and I've been fortunate enough to do that, I don't know on how many occasions, we'll stand there with our own thoughts as we listen to those buglers. But here we've got inside the mind of a man that served in those battlefields. And no doubt he recognised the names of many of the men on those panels as he stood beneath it listening to the buglers. And then we return to the book that I mentioned earlier by H.A. Taylor. And he describes what Ypres meant to him. He said that Ypres seems to have a strange effect. I felt it on all of my visits. It was particularly strong on one occasion, and a friend who accompanied me visiting Ypres for the first time since the war spoke about it also, entirely without any prompting from me. There is something grim and something eerie about Ypres, despite the fact that few traces of the war remain. It seems fantastic to suggest that this city, so new, so bright, so clean, with so much beautiful Flemish craftsmanship to be seen in its reconstructed streets, should have the effect that upon the visitor. Perhaps it does not affect those who have not an emotional interest, and certainly it is entirely inexplicable. I can only record that for all its disguise, Ypres still casts on the spirit of those who knew it in other times, a sombre thought which the brightest sunshine cannot remove. At Skindle's Hotel at dinner one evening, I counted 10 men who were obviously ex-servicemen, mostly, I should say, ex-officers. Some were in pairs at tables and had been travelling together, yet there was hardly any conversation. All had been out viewing Ypres and the salient, and not even the influence of good food and wine could move us to normal conversation. A word now and then, a forced laugh. For the rest, meditative silence. This is the effect of Ypres on the returned soldier. How could it be otherwise, when so much exists here which stirs the heart to its depths? After a tour, impressions on the day's events marshal themselves in your mind and are exhibited as a film. Always there will be cemeteries at frequent intervals in that film. Here at Ypres, it's etched upon your mind the acre close to the walls of the old prison known as Ypres Reservoir Cemetery. Here you encounter side by side the graves of brigadier generals and of humble privates of the Labour Corps, or an army chaplain, and many men of the military police who fell in the unspectacular but hazardous duty of directing traffic on crossroads that were ever the target of enemy guns. Taylor then describes in his book how he goes up onto the battlefield and up to Passchendaele. He says, "You miss the British signboards and horse lines and the cookies giving off savoury odours behind some old barn or in a crude lean-to. And they are so quiet, these places. You miss the rumble of limbered wagons and guns, the brisk step of troops marching to training grounds and the slow drag of battalions just out of the line, fatigued, mindful of losses. The inhabitants of Ypres, as ever, are courteous and amiable, and they look at you a little curiously. They are not the inhabitants that you once knew. Yes, of course, all that was many years ago. How old one is getting, feeling a little tired too. It's late when you return to Ypres. The square is deserted. The moonlight makes the new cathedral look ghostly. The ruined tower of the Cloth Hall throws a long shadow. How still and silent it is here. The banging of a door on the far side of the square makes you start. You started like that in Ypres at other times. Two exuberant young Belgians go by singing, then silence again. A little beyond the square, at the end of the narrow street that leads to the Menin Road, a bright light attracts your attention. The lights of Ypres are dim, religious lights, and this is a stronger beam. It is shining in the centre of the arch of the Menin Gate, flooding the whole of its white stone with light. The beacon draws you, but after a few paces you pause. Not again. You are content with this distant view. A nearer approach might spoil the vista. It is all very beautiful, but it is not Ypres. Happily, it is not. You recall the description that you saw this morning on a wreath under the archway. A few words from the book of Revelation. For the former things are passed away." He also says that Ypres is a quiet city after sunset, and away over the salient from Zillebeek to Passchendaele and about St. Julien, where the vile gas clouds rode, where the vile gas clouds rolled over unprotected men, seldom a sound breaks the peace of evening. It may well be that when the wind is kindly, the silver notes of the bugles are carried across the fields and beaks and little farms, echoing amongst the headstones and floating over the undetected graves of those men to whom this was the piece of music, of a rest after duty. And he's talking, of course, there about the buglers playing at the last post ceremony. Now, going back to Will Bird, he talks about then leaving Ypres and going up the Menin Road, but his journey's blocked and he has to make a detour because at the Burr Road crossroads, where there's now a cemetery, the Menin Road itself had caved in. And it's not surprising, really, when you can imagine the amount of dugouts that were there and are still there to this day. And in his book, he says all traffic detours and even the tramway has been shifted. A huge opening is there and scores of men are working to fill it in. The road dropped into a huge tunnel, strongly timbered. It was constructed by the 14th Division in 1915 and an immense amount of timber has been removed. The tunnel runs on past Hoog, and the road has collapsed at the junction with Cambridge Road, where an underground aid post was established. Rotted tunics and kilts and caps and trousers, all kinds of equipment and uniforms have been brought up from the dark cavities below, and the tunnel stretches away a seemingly endless distance. The chasm is 40 feet deep and 50 feet square, and it looks as if a gallery runs from the dugout to Hoog, and no one seems to know whether or not the Germans were making use of this underground place. And then he's written a poem about Ypres. And in this poem, we get to understand in his own words what Ypres looked like when he visited there. And the poem is read by a professional actress called Jennifer Haig. And Jennifer herself has an ancestor and a great uncle that died on the Somme in the opening day, on the opening day of the Battle of the Somme, 1st of July 1916, serving with the 10th Battalion of the West Yorkshires. And he's buried in Freecorn. She visited his grave with me early this year. And I asked her to, as she's a professional actress, record this poem. And as you can see, she reads it absolutely beautifully.
Rain. Rain and mist. And slow obscuring clouds. And mile on mile. And league on league of bog. A waste where desolation outruns sight. A shell-torn track, one time the busy road, trails slightly on where no man passes by. Guarded on either side by poor white ghosts, the gaunt and spectral trees which still must stand though dead. A highway of calamity. Past grass-grown mounds, not graves of men, but graves of towns, all havoc and decay, long lost beneath the weeds, the oneness of the plain. Beyond, far down the waste, as in a dream, the phantom city rises through the mist. Some broken towers, clustered broken walls set in a rampart, like a shattered crown the ruin lies. Alone in level miles, that tragic pointing witness holds the heart of all the woe the brooding stillness hides. Of all the terror, misery, disgust, of all the splendour, fortitude and will that met the first great battle and endured. Such is the salient after 4 years' war.
Now, Taylor then leaves Ypres and he goes out onto the battlefields themselves. And the first place he comes to, or one of the first places he comes to, is now the site of a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery. But it's one of those original cemeteries that was established in September of 1917, and it's called Bridge House Cemetery. And it was obviously named after a farmhouse, as many of them were. And it's so small. Most of the burials in here come from the Battle of Polygon Wood that took place in September 1917. And are men from the 59th North Midland Division. There's only 45 of them, and four of them are unidentified. And it's here that our man, Will Bird, came to. He says, at Bridge House Farm, there is a section of ground that has not been tilled. It is a chaos full of shell craters, grass-grown, and the bed of the light railway lines can easily be traced. Most of the men one meets in the salient seem adverse to conversation and are not friendly. Now, what he's doing here, he's talking about the locals that have returned to the battlefields. And what they're trying to do, of course, is farm their land again. They need to do this because it's their only income, it's their job, that's what they do. And, of course, it must have been very difficult for those Belgian farmers returning to the battlefields. And Will says, they hate all things connected with the war. One spoke bitterly in his rough-throated fashion as he told me how his son had been killed in 1921 through the explosion of a shell. These English made poor shells, he finished angrily. They should have exploded at the time. I pointed out that it was quite possible that his son had uncovered a German shell, but he would not have that side of it. No, he was sure it was the English that caused all the deaths. It's easy with hindsight to feel grumpy about that Belgian farmer. And of course, he's not thinking logically, but how could you think logically? He's trying to make an income through farming the ground. And just a few years earlier, he's lost his son. He's lost his son in a civilian world when he thought the killing was over and it wasn't for him. There's no wonder he felt like he did, even if it was misplaced anger. It's easy to forget, isn't it, that the Great War continued to affect the civilians and the farmers and the veterans from those battlefields for many, many years to come. And it still does, of course. Now, we then goes to Hill 60 near Zillebeek. Goes up the road that we drive up when we go from Zillebeek, the village, up to Hill 60. And what he sees at Hill 60 is very different to what we see today. It's been preserved, of course. The shell holes are still there. The crater from 1917 on the right-hand side is still there. Some of the pillboxes, although damaged, are still there. But there's a path that has been laid in recent years, which makes it easy for the modern tourist to walk about Hill 60. But this was a very different scene to what Will discovered when he went there, because still open and had not been sealed were the tunnels and the galleries beneath the battlefield. This is what he says from his account. From Zillebeek, the road leads up to Hill 60, one of the most exploited places in the salient. Even as you reach the few squalid homes, you meet huge signs telling you of this or that canteen, advertising the sale of souvenirs, postcards. Wooden canteens are there, and then one meets a fenced-in area. Inside, the proprietor is very cordial and gentlemanly and really has something to show you. He's cleaned out all the trenches on the British side of the hill. The old corrugated iron sides hold position, and duck mats are there. Strewn about is all the debris of war he uncovered in his work. Countless steel helmets, gas masks, cartridge clips, rifles, bayonets, a gas alarm, and a fixed rifle. There is a tall steel tower with steps up which you go at your own risk, and from its height survey all the salient and much beyond. During the summer seasons, tables are put up all around Hill 60, and the canteens have competition from vendors, postcards, fruit and drinks, tea, coffee and chocolate. All the hill is a festering sore on the landscape. There is an immense crater next to the railroad that is waterfilled in the wet season. The hill was so shelled and tunnelled and mined that it is a morass. Go where you will, you'll find traces of old shafts and cuttings and dugouts and the ruins of pillboxes. All the German ones are sunken beneath the surface, and only pieces serve to show you where they lie. Down by the trenches, the enterprising proprietor has cleaned the tunnels he located there. One goes down a flight of steps into the evil-smelling underground. Long galleries lean in different directions. Supports and braces have been fixed in many places, but the whole area seems a risky passage. There one can see where meals were cooked, the charred beams giving mute evidence, and remnants of old gas curtains are still in place. Spades and tools are still there. I went along two turnings and into a very small gallery, low and narrow. It had water a foot deep and would daunt almost anyone. You can see the way he describes it, why those tunnels have been sealed now. And no doubt everything that he described is still there, but the modern tourists like you and me will never see it. We'll just have to imagine it, won't we? Bird then heads to the north, and he ends up at Pau Capelle. And as people know that have been there, there's an enormous Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery that we talked about in a recent podcast. And when he visited, he discovered a terrible story of one of those burial parties from a few years earlier that was helping build the cemetery and bury the dead. He says the burial party were working at the cemetery and stopped to heat their dinner and make tea. As they sat around, there was a terrible explosion, and every man was blown to pieces. Either they had made their fire over a large shell, which had been fired by the heat, or they were victims of a landmine. Now, as far as I know, there were no landmines on the battlefield. How on earth could you plant landmines in that muddy morass that was there in 1917? So it's, as the writer predicted, it must have been maybe a spark from the fire that set off a hidden high explosive shell, or whatever the reason for the explosion. Several members of what was then the Imperial War Graves Commission, possibly they were veterans that survived the fighting, only to be killed whilst brewing up a pot of tea. Now, I just remembered as I was reading that down in Ypres, at the Ypres Town Cemetery extension, there are several burials from men and women that work for the Imperial, or we now call the Commonwealth War Graves Commission. And I wonder whether those men that died in that explosion are some of those that are buried in that particular cemetery. I'll have to have a look next time I go, see if there's any clues. He also talks about a sergeant in one of the Scottish units, and he returned to Ypres after the war to marry a local girl that he'd met during the conflict. But this man had a brother who'd served many long, hard months at Ypres, and he was always obsessed with a premonition that he would be buried there in Ypres. And he managed to survive the war. At the end of the war, he went home, relieved, no doubt, that his premonition wasn't true. But after the war, he'd saved up enough money to make a pilgrimage and he made his way to Ypres. Now, we don't know whether it was the excitement or the stress at again seeing the town that had held such terrible memories for him, but when he went through the Lille Gate, he dropped dead there. And he was buried in one of the Ypres cemeteries. And of course, it meant that his premonition was actually fulfilled. So continuing with the journey of Will Byrd, on his journey to the battlefields in 1931, we now go down, as he did, to the Somme battlefields. And his first stop on the Somme is Courcelette. And this village is famous for the Canadians taking it during the tank battle of September 15th, 1916. But when Will goes there, he meets one of the people from Courcelette, who he describes as an original, someone that lived there before the Canadians attacked. And she was living there for 18 months of German occupation. And she talked about a German officer kicking his men whilst on parade. She said that the British shells came very near and the Germans were remarkably adept at taking cover. And said that after the people came back to the ruins of Courcelette and started rebuilding, they found many German dead in the cellars, where they'd been crushed by the barrage preceding the capture on September the 15th. Will says that we went outside and found a road leading towards Regina Trench. Going along it at a distance into the old sunken road, we soon came to men shovelling earth on a winter cache of vegetables. In their digging, they were very near the road bank, and they had uncovered two German helmets, German long boots, mess tins, equipment, and a few bones. They said they did not mind as long as there were no shells or bombs. Never did they plough or harrow, they told us, but they uncovered some debris of war. We found a section of rough ground, seemingly an old trench, and judging from my map, a part of old Kinora Trench. There was no trace of Regina Trench or Hessian or Zollern Redoubt. We wandered away over towards Tietvau in our search of a trace of Desire Trench and found none, or any war signs near Moquet Farm. On the soft ground it was a long, tiresome tramp, and there was not a trace of old trenches as a reward. Only those with very vivid memories could now point out the exact lines that were assaulted during those terrible autumn days of 1916. The Germans still talk of the bloodbath of the Somme, and all veterans agree that for terrific shellfire among conditions of mud and water in terrible weather, the Battle of the Somme was only exceeded in dreadfulness by the Battle of Passchendaele. For every Victoria Cross awarded there, 100 were equally well won. And that's a thought that often comes back to me as well when we're talking of Victoria Crosses, when we're reading the citations of those men that received the highest award in the British armies. What about all those others, like Will Byrd says here, all those other men that carried out equally brave actions but were never witnessed or never reported? And maybe those men were killed, or maybe they weren't. So many more Victoria Crosses, Distinguished Conduct Awards, Military Crosses, Military Medals could no doubt have been awarded. And as we talked about in a previous podcast, there's been a campaign in recent years to award posthumously the Military Cross to Walter Toll, a man from Northampton, where I live. For me, I don't believe that's right. I don't believe you can go back in time and retrospectively apply rewards for history for things that happened so long ago. What about all the others? It's an impossible task, really. He then moves down to La Boisselle, and he says, "You see old gun positions and parts of trenches, and rough contours are frequent as you look over Mash and Blighty valleys. Left and right, these old craters and trench holes become more plentiful. And then you're at La Boisselle, in the very heart of the war-torn area. It's a tiny village. A few heroic ones have tried to reclaim that wilderness, but only the main street and another lane have resulted. All else are craters, shell holes, gullies, rifts in the earth, barren in spots of anything that grows." And then what he does, he comes across one of the two craters that were in La Boisselle in those days, the Wysap crater, and the crater that we know and have visited many times, the Lotnagar crater. But he says, "To the right, a gate bears a large sign. Going through it and over the slippery chalk soil, you reach the lips of an enormous crater. While we stood there, a carload of tourists came. They were gazing all about them, remarking on the condition of the village ground. that when they reached the crater, they stood silent and went away, saying very little. They'd got a glimpse of war. We crossed to the other road, went over it and to the other huge crater. All about it, desolation extends like a terrible wound. In smaller craters, we saw much refuse of war, and then in a shell hole, probed at a leather end and found it to be entire equipment. Nearby was a water bottle and a bayonet. A steel helmet, jagged by a shrapnel cut, showed where a rotting ground sheet held long German boots. Wandering around, we saw countless other relics, as if the place had never been visited. Below the village, there's a memorial to the Tyneside Irish and the Tyneside Scottish. They were in that vicinity when those craters were blown on July the 1st, 1916, and the great battle of the Somme commenced. He then met a local that told him about a story which, I don't know, when I read this, maybe it's a tall story, maybe it isn't, maybe it's true. But he says that over near Trones Wood, a German was found digging industriously about a year after the war. He claimed that a pay officer of his regiment had been buried alive there by a big shell, and that the man had five watches in his pockets, as well as the battalion pay in a leather satchel. He was rather rudely advised to stop digging. So what he's trying to tell us there is that this veteran had returned to Trones Wood, trying to find the corpse carrying those watches and that cash. Sounds a bit unlikely, but I don't know. Perhaps it is true. We'll never know. Times were extremely hard for the German veterans going back to their country after the war. And when people are desperate, they do desperate things, don't they? Now, like Captain Taylor from earlier, Bird talks about the iron harvests and what they find on the battlefields. He says, when I came to France, I was told that the French government had cleaned the land of all war debris. Three different times they've gone over the long battle line, searching, probing, cleaning off every shell and relic. Yet you cannot go 1 mile today in a battle zone without finding shells and war material showing. Some say that the land is settling each year and thus exposing 9.2s and old fuses. Others will tell you that the metal is working upward and will continue to do so. I do not know. But along the Somme, I saw more 18-pounders at farm gates, more old bombs and wire stakes and scrap metal than anywhere else I've been. Go in a farmyard and you'll see German pot helmets used as wash basins and bowls for chicken feed. And in the kitchens, you may find bayonets used as stove pokers. Well, if you talk with the locals, they'll tell you they'll soon unearth some relic that they are keeping as a treasure. It may be the badge of an English regiment, an old flare pistol or a Luger, or perhaps an iron cross. And it happens many times. I remember several times walking through the village of Mametz, and a local will come out and in broken English invite you in to see his private collection of stuff that he found on the battlefields, even in the last few years. And recently I was in Bicor on the Somme, the village of Bicor, just close to the Lac Neagar crater, and a farmer came along and he showed me photographs of a German casualty that he'd found while ploughing the battlefields near the village of Milt. Now that must have been a casualty from maybe 1918, because in 1916 that area was all in British hands, but in 1918 during the German spring offensive they went through, and they could tell from parts of his uniform that it must have been after 1917. So it's still happening. It wasn't true that the French government had cleaned all the land. Of course it wasn't. That would have been impossible. And I also remember another occasion when I took a family to Pau Capelle near Ypres, that we mentioned earlier, a place that we mentioned earlier. And it was a Sunday afternoon and we were standing there looking at this road near a barn. And as with so many of these old farms up on the Passchendaele Ridge, it had been used, the ruins of it, the original farm had been used by Germans as a defensive position. And as we were doing this, the family of the farm that's there now came out and they took us into their barn. And within this barn, there was a massive amount of broken shells, shrapnel balls. But horrifically, they had lots and lots of boots, army boots, German boots, British boots. And as you looked at those, you thought, well, at some stage, a man that's now one of the fallen of the Great War had worn those boots. It was always something very personal when you see them, because you realise that a human being from whatever country was once wearing those boots when he was killed. Bird finishes his account talking about what they find on the battlefield. He says, the people will tell you endless stories about those killed or maimed through disturbing explosives, about the things they've seen in old dugouts and cellars when they first returned to their lands, and they will talk to you of bodies found until your flesh crawls. Whether or not they've concocted such entertainment for tourists, I cannot say. Now, Bird says that he wasn't happy with his visit to Courcelette. He said he wanted to have another look at the sunken road there, so he went back, and he says it's banked as high as your shoulder, and on top you can see the long white lines that indicate old trenches. A farmer came along, riding an immense horse, and asked what I was looking for. He began to talk as soon as I explained, and he told me they'd seen at least 100 bodies taken from that sunken road. When they'd cleaned it and made it wide enough for traffic, they found British and German weapons of all kinds. Bombs, shells, everything, even a huge cheese under the mounds of shell-piled earth. Only last summer, he said, a boy had had his arm blown off by a bomb explosion as he played in the Somme fields. And the farmer said he'd seen an auto, a car, blown from the road as it detonated a shell. He then went to Trones Wood, and he said that just 5 minutes at its death, depths soon convinced me that the truth had been told about its condition. Old wire and stakes and rotten stubs and holes of all kinds are there, and the young growth has made it like a jungle. A tall shaft in memory of men and officers of the 18th Division stands in the fringe of the wood. Now, at the time I'm recording this, it's 21st of November, so the day after the beginning of the 2 week battle for Cambrai. And in the middle of that battlefield is Bourlon Wood. And this is where Bird goes. He said, Bourlon Wood looks thick and impassable, with old stubs here and there, and the fringe of it is gouged by sandpits or gravel pits. We turn right and go round the wood and into the village, which was captured by the Canadians on the 27th of September 1918. It is downhill past wooden huts and Nissen huts and more wooden huts. There are more huts in Bourlon than any other village we'd seen. There are many more ruins by far than any other place, and it's dirtier than any other village in the region. The house is almost ugly, rough red brick with only one or two changes of painted concrete in the place. The church is rebuilt without beauty and is on the side slope of greasy mud. The big chateau has vanished. It remained, rather the ruins were there, until this summer, when they were considered too dangerous and were all levelled to the ground. Only the battered long wall remains, and the ruins of the stables. Now, the reason why I quoted that bit is, if you go to Bourlon now, the village itself, of course, go and visit the Canadian Memorial, and you can go into the wood itself. If you go down past the church and turn left and then left again, you'll come to a dead end. But on the left-hand side, you'll find the remains of that single wall that's left standing that Bird talks about in his book, that battered long wall. And it's full of shrapnel marks, but there's also a couple of big holes in there where large shells have gone right the way through. And I always stand there and think, you know, if that's what artillery can do to a thick wall, what on earth could it do to a human being? And then Bird goes to Albert, the British base town behind the lines. And he says, I met a small wan with a giant moustache and a thirst of an empty camel. He told me of a dugout he'd had up at Ypres where the rats were so big and fat they resembled poodle dogs. He trained one to do many tricks, making it so tame that he got a small dog collar for it. It used to cross over no man's land and one night came back with a message tied to its collar. After that, he corresponded regularly with a pleasant Otto, German he means, over the way who could write fair English and swap badges with him and smoke tobacco. The rat always had jam after making one of the trips. Finally, a relief on the enemy side sent Otto away and brought in an outfit of Bavarians who were most slurring and insulting in their initial message. So our rat tamer had a brainwave. He taught his pet one thing only for 7 straight days and then sent him over the way with 2 Mills bombs across his back tied together. The rat slid them off in the German trench, nipped out the pins and beat it, and the unfriendly ones were blown to the fatherland. I don't know. I suppose if you're in a pub 13 years after and you meet up with a man, a few beers, then maybe he did have a rat, But did he really tie two bombs? Did that rat really have the intelligence to detonate them and then get out of the way? I'll leave that for you to decide. He said, at Amiens, I met a taxi driver who had a fearful scar on his neck. I asked him if it was a war injury, and he said it was. He's got it while bathing in the canal, Lille Nabas, the result of more German war guilt. I'm going to read this, but again, this sounds, I don't think this can be true. But the reason I'm reading it, although it's probably not true, it just gives you an idea of the conversations that these veterans had when they met after the war. He said, each day he and his chums had a bath in the cooling water, and this time he was attacked by a most ferocious fish, which had almost severed his head from his body. He said it was commonly known in that sector that the Germans imported the fish from East Africa and that they were fiercer than sharks. The British, he said, put explosives into the water, and 49 of these monsters floated to the surface. They measured 7 feet in length and had a sword-like nose, and their hides make excellent leggings. The British, he reckons, had arrangements underway to bring over a shipment of cobra snakes from India, but the snakes could not survive such a long journey. They were supposed to be led over to the German lines by the Indians and let loose. So come on then, class. Hands up, those of you who believe that tale about snakes and big fish being used as weapons in the Great War. Not sure my hand is up, to be honest. But it, you know, as I said earlier, it does give you an idea of what these lads did when they met up again on the battlefields. They did exactly the same as what blokes do now when they sit in pubs. They talk absolute nonsense with each other. Now, one of the things that we talk about a lot is the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries now. And in Taylor's book, he talks about his feelings about the cemeteries and the work of the commission and its gardeners all those years ago. He said, talking to an official of the commission is like chatting to an enthusiastic landscape gardener with a real gardener's gentleness and love of beauty. There was a note of pride in his description of the schemes, architectural and horticultural, employed in the cemeteries. No two schemes are alike. Here stone walls and rambler roses, there brick walls with paved pathways. The cemetery in the orchard at Warloy is a perfect picture when the blossom is out. You should see that. And the turf in some of the cemeteries in May would not be shamed by the lawns of an English university. Truly, there is a heartbeat in the work of the Imperial War Graves Commission. That you learn in the very first cemetery you visit. Taylor goes on to talk in more detail about the gardeners. He calls them the wardens of these cemeteries are all British ex-soldiers, picked men and good fellows. You come upon them at odd times. As you stand contemplating some familiar stretch of country, you hear beyond a hedge the whir of a lawnmower. Looking about, you find a cemetery in which a man, suntanned, collarless and jacketless, is pushing a mower over the green sword about the headstones. His cycle rests by the gate. He may be the only man who you'll encounter in an hour's walk. Probably he lives amongst the French peasants in an adjacent village. Maybe he shared with them the hardships of the early days of peace, living in a rough shack or in a tent among the ruins. He works largely without supervision. No foreman stands by to keep him at it. None is needed. He's doing this for his pals. That he's employed by the Imperial War Graves Commission is almost incidental. The person who sets out to tour the battlefields with a timetable would destroy it after the first day. These cemeteries have a way of dissipating time. One lingers in them, and I would give little for the heart of the man who could resist their call. I read that passage because it's as though time stood still. Of course, the wardens, as he calls them, that look after the cemeteries are no longer there. They're long gone. And the people that look after the cemeteries now are local contractors, in particular French and Belgium. But nothing has changed. We still have those same feelings when we visit the cemeteries now. And when you talk to these gardeners, you know that just like those ex-soldiers, the fact that they're now working for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission is also largely irrelevant because these people are doing it for the love of the work that they're so carefully doing. Taylor continues his walk and he says, in much the same way the former British soldier who served on the Somme may look out for his old home and will look with much less chance of success. Except for two sections of trench lines which have been preserved as war memorials to which you will find no trenches. Grass grows and cows feed where once below ground was a battalion headquarters, complete with telephones, typewriter, maps, papers, and a gramophone, all gone without a trace, and green grass or beet or corn growing on the top. Was the war, after all, only the hideous nightmare that it seemed? He talks about, on a previous visit, how he'd seen the wooden crosses that are now replaced by headstones, features of the landscape which, to the soldier, are as familiar as the centre of his own town or village, are not to be seen, or they elude one's eyes. Then, too, the isolated graves have gone, all gathered into the nearest God's Acre. It is better thus, infinitely better. But once the wooden crosses which marked them were distinctive features of the battlefields, which the soldiers knew, but now they're gone. He then went to the village of Mametz, and he picked up a story that someone told him, that despite the fact that the village was blown from the face of the earth, and there was not a square foot of ground without a shell hole, the mayor, on his return to the village after the war, was able to dig up from his garden, in perfect condition, a supply of wine which he'd buried there in 1914. There were many parched throats in Mametz in July 1916, but the mayor's improvised cellar eluded them, as it eluded the worst that terrific bombardment could do. And the last passage which I wanted to read to you from his tour of the battlefield comes from Gullimont. And whenever I do a talk on behalf of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, we talk about the quality of the treatment of soldiers in death, if not in life, that every soldier will be treated the same. And this was really important to Taylor. And he visits the Gullimont Road Cemetery. And he says, here is buried the brilliant son of one who was, at the time of this battle, the Prime Minister of Britain. And he's talking about Raymond Asquith, the son of the Prime Minister, H.H. Asquith. Taylor says, equality of sacrifice requires equality of treatment. And thus you must seek for this grave as you seek for that of any private soldier. At last you come upon it, one of a long line, and the stone, exactly the same as any other, records that here is buried Lieutenant Raymond Asquith of the Grenadier Guards, killed on the 15th of September, aged 37. Then follows a remarkable inscription, the one touch of individual choice permitted to the relatives of each fallen man. And the inscription reads, small time, but in that small time, most greatly lived this Star of England. The Prime Minister of those days, Taylor says, had an experience permitted to few fathers. He met his two soldier sons on the battlefield. His duties took him to France in September 1916, and he actually witnessed some of the fighting on the Somme, including the debut of the tanks. And so far as Raymond Asquith was concerned, perhaps this almost unique experience was unfortunate, for within a fortnight, the sorely burdened statesman received news of the death of his elder son, and the recent meeting must have made the blow even harder to bear than otherwise it might have been. He wrote at the time of his loss, the war has sucked up so much of what was most lovable and full of promise that I've always been haunted by a fear that a toll would be exacted from me also. When I saw Raymond last, a fortnight ago, he was so radiantly strong and confident that I came away from France with an easier mind. Whatever pride I had in the past, whatever hope I had for the future, by much the largest part of both was vested in him. Now all of that is gone. And, of course, it'll have been no different to all the other fathers that lost their sons on the battlefields. Part of them died with their sons. But in Asquith's case, it led directly, indirectly, I don't know. But a few months later, he was replaced as the Prime Minister by Lloyd George. And now, as we get to the end of this podcast, we look through the eyes of the soldiers that we've been discussing their closing thoughts. Will Bird, he talks about the Germans, who he says their veterans gaze moodily down the Menin Road, thinking no doubt how near they were to victory, and yet so far. They stand and dream at Vimy Ridge, and spend hours on end at various spots along the Somme. The German seems a thinker of serious things. I've talked with many of them and found them very broad-minded in their viewpoints, and I've seen big, grizzled veterans with Iron Cross ribbons under the lapel of their jackets stand at Zonnebeek and Passchendaele and look over the great sweep of black and white grave memorials until tears streamed down their cheeks and they could not speak at all. Then in the hotels in the evening, when they did talk, they bitterly denounced all things that had come to pass since 1918. Such attitudes have given me a closing story. He says a party of old crocs used as pioneers was sent to an isolated point during the last days of the war and had no rumours of proceedings until the armistice morning, when the young officer in charge received the all-important message. He at once fell in the party, adjusted his monocle and read the news in very grave and impressive tones. After he had finished, there was a heavy silence. Then an old Cockney sergeant stepped forward and saluted. "Beg pardon, sir," he said, "but who's won?" Then as Lieutenant Colonel T.A. Lowe, the man who was commanding the Royal Irish Fusiliers 1st Battalion, on the last page of his book, he says, "The little crosses on the hillside mark the rest billets of our comrades of the trenches. They haven't really left us. They're only on ahead, like scouts, finding out the way. One day we will join them, and then they will guide us over no man's land and that friendly country of peace and rest and happiness. Meanwhile, they stand on guard along the battlefront. Lest us not forget." And as we know, it's now 14 years since the last of those veterans has moved on, has gone across the spiritual no man's land and into that country of peace and rest and happiness on the other side. But like he says in those last few words, lest us not forget. And we don't forget, because we visit the battlefields, we read books, we stand at war memorials, and we think about those men and women that gave up their lives for us so that we can live the free lives that we do today. And I wonder whether the soldiers that we've quoted in this podcast, as they walked the battlefields and saw those familiar sights and looked for trenches that are no longer there, I wonder whether their minds went back, whether their memories went back to the battlefields, and wondered whether at home, if their families were keeping those home fires burning.
They were summoned from the hillside. They were called in from the glen. And the country found them ready at the stirring call for men. Let not his add to
home. There's
Quite stirring words within that famous song, and thoughts within those lyrics must have been amongst everybody that served on the Great War, in the Great War, both at home and abroad. They must have dreaded that letter or that telegram or that knock on the door coming, mustn't they? And we don't know what that was like, thankfully, and hopefully we never will. Thank you once again for tuning in to this podcast that I, Terry Wenham, call Tales from the Battlefields. And next week's podcast is already recorded. As we go back to Passchendaele and we look at a battle that goes beyond November 1917, when history tells us that Passchendaele ended, and it looks at a small action known as a nighttime operation beyond or on the Passchendaele Ridge called a Moonlight Massacre. And there's a man that's an expert on this very small action called Michael Locorico. I think that's how you pronounce his name. Sorry, Michael, if I've got that wrong. Probably have. And he comes on and gives us a fantastic explanation of why that operation was so important, what went wrong, and we look at some of the stories. We look at the battle as usual through the eyes of the men that were there. But for this week, that's it. And we're going to end as usual by playing The Last Post. And as we do so, of course, we think about the men that are remembered on the Menin Gate, but we also think about those veterans, as we've discussed in this podcast, who stood at the Menin Gate in the years that followed the war, and what went through, we wonder what went through their mind as they looked up at the 54,000 or 55,000 names above their heads. And remember those words of General Plumer when he opened the Menin Gate: they are not missing, they are here.